From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, the Dallas police chief said authorities are downloading more than 170 hours of body camera footage and collecting countless hours of video recorded on dash cams as they try to piece together the events of last week that led to the shooting deaths of five law enforcement officials in Dallas. Chief David Brown also said that they were trying to discern what led the shooter to target them.
I am a little bit old school cop. Until you show me we've exhausted every lead, I'm not going to be convinced that we know everything about what happened, associations, others that might be complicit. So we're going to turn over every rock.
The shooter's parents are saying he returned from a deployment in Afghanistan a changed man. Delphine Johnson said her son became a hermit after 6 years in the Army Reserves. And the father, James Johnson, said the family was shocked at what had happened. Here they are speaking on the Blaze website.
I didn't see it coming.
Talk about Micah, honey.
He was a good son.
He was a good son.
I love my son with all my heart. I hate what he did.
The parents of shooter Micah Johnson. Well, today, after the deaths in Dallas and the shooting deaths of blacks by police, there are calls, sometimes from the same people, for respect for the police, law and order, and a need to address the institutional racism that the government itself recognized in Department of Justice reports. That sounds like 1968, when the Kerner Report, commissioned by then-President Johnson, issued a scathing finding on a country divided, black and white. But this weekend, President Obama said any comparison to the polarization of the 60s, when cities like Detroit and Newark saw race riots after the incidents of police brutality, is just not true.
You're not seeing riots, and you're not seeing police going after people who are protesting peacefully. You've seen almost uniformly peaceful protests, and you've seen uniformly police handling those protests with professionalism.
Our next guest agrees that despite the horror of recent violence against African Americans and police, we are not close to the burning cities, not to mention assassinations of the 60s. But he wonders if today the political response may be moving in the wrong direction, as it did in 1968. Julian Zelitzer is a professor of history and public affairs at the Princeton Woodrow Wilson School. His piece about the Kerner Report is in The Atlantic. There's a link at hereandnow.org. Julian joins us from New York. Julian, welcome as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's fascinating to be reminded that there were two Kerner reports. The first one was rejected, killed by President Johnson, who, like President Obama, was seen as someone who could affect change in race relations. But he was hamstrung by resurgent conservative Southern Democrats, the failing war in Vietnam. He didn't think he could affect change. So he actually stacked the original Kerner Commission with people unlikely to suggest change. And still, what did the first report, and then it was killed, the second report, what did they say?
Yeah, the first report was a draft by social scientists working for this commission, and it was called The America of Racism, and it was really hard-hitting. It said the Great Society programs were fine, but they basically offered tokenism and token solutions to the problem of what they called the white power structure that dominated American economic and political life. So it was really tough on the way politics and power was distributed, and really critical of the Great Society, which were Johnson's programs. The second report was not quite as hard-hitting, but it was pretty tough in retrospect. The famous line is that we are moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And it also talked about institutional racism, the way racism is inscribed into everything from housing to employment and to policing.
Yeah. And they also said it was creating a peoples in America, a truly revolutionary spirit, an unwillingness to compromise or wait any longer to risk death rather than have their people continue in a subordinate status. That was actually the first report that was next, but somewhat, you know, the same language in the second. And yet Johnson, as we said, was hamstrung. Despite the report becoming popular, just to remind people, it was a bestseller. Actor Marlon Brando read parts of it on the Joey Bishop TV show.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It became a real phenomenon when it came out. It was a bestseller. Tom Wicker wrote an introduction to it. Marlon Brando goes on the Joey Bishop show and reads parts of it. And people are having reading groups all over the country. And it's all over the media. And the language in this is really striking. I mean, it's talking about white racism and, again, issues like policing. But politics moved in a very different direction. It wasn't the liberals who won the day. It was Richard Nixon with his calls for law and order.
Richard Nixon leading the call, the charge for law and order. And as you say, that's the direction that the country chose to go in, despite the government knowing that there was a problem. You see potential parallels to today. What do you see?
I do. I mean, look, President Obama is correct. There's been a lot of progress. We haven't had the kind of rioting we saw in Newark and Detroit, but that doesn't mean the problems are not pretty severe. In the criminal justice system, as the prime example, we have seen how racial disparities are constantly at work, from arrests to how officers handle those arrests to the penal system. And those are all issues that were dealt with in the Kerner Report. They are not new. These are deeply rooted in American society, and we didn't deal with them in 1968. So it's not just that this is like 1968. We've actually never solved the problems this report pointed to.
Though we have to say that it's different in many ways, including you can't broad brush. There are people, police across the board, who are condemning the racist actions they see, the systemic racism they see. It is different.
Absolutely, there's been great progress in how we understand race and the care with which police give these situations. We also have to remember everything wasn't broadcast back in 1968. So now there's a lot more pressure when the police are there. They are under the microscope in a way that wasn't true in the late 1960s.
Well, they're under their own microscope, too, when you have chiefs like Brown in Dallas. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Thank you so much. We'll link you. And by the way, you wrote the introduction to a new edition of the Kerner Report. We'll link you at hearnow.org.
Thank you.
Well, some big political news in the UK today. Prime Minister David Cameron said he will step down on Wednesday, and Theresa May, the Home Secretary, has been elected the new leader of the Conservative Party. Cameron had promised to resign after the Brexit vote. He led the Remain campaign. And by the way, May was on his side. But here's what she said after the vote went against them.
Brexit means Brexit. The campaign was fought, the vote was held, turnout was high, and the public gave their verdict. There must be no attempts to remain inside the EU, no attempts to rejoin it through the back door, and no second referendum.
May became the likely prime minister after her chief rival, Andrea Leadsom, announced today that she was pulling out of the race. The BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, joins us from London. And Rob, another political shocker here. Why did Leadsom drop out of this race to be the next prime minister?
Goodness, what has happened to British politics? I always used to tell people that one of the things that made Britain the kind of country that it is, an agreeable country, is that its politics are boring and the people that live here aren't interested very much in politics. I got to say, actually, that I think the latter bit is still true. Why did she drop out? Well, I think basically she thought she was going to have a very hard time even if she won the race. What I mean by that is that the Conservative MPs, the 330 Conservative MPs, they clearly preferred Theresa May. And although it was possible that Andrea Leadsom would win among the sort of 150,000 or so Conservative Party activists around the country, I think she didn't like the prospect as a very kind of junior person in politics of standing there in Parliament and realizing that you had an awful lot of enemies behind you.
And Theresa May, by the way, campaigned against Brexit during the run-up to the referendum. But she, as we heard there, said Brexit means Brexit. Any doubts about whether she will actually go through with it?
Not after having said that. I mean, she'd be courting revolution, I think. I mean, there are an awful lot of people that wish that she wouldn't say that because they think that all of the warnings of the Remain campaign that she was part of are coming true about Britain's economy, Britain's place in the world, you name it, that it's all come true. But I think the problem that she faces and understands, and I think a lot of opponents of Brexit understand this, maybe rather regretfully, is that you really would have a revolution on your hands. I mean, how are you going to explain it to the 17 million people who voted to leave that we are in fact staying?
So when do you expect her to trigger Article 50 to actually do it, take Britain out?
I don't think she's going to be in any rush about that at all. And I don't think she's been quite clever to be saying, look, you know, yes, of course, Britain needs to renegotiate this relationship with the European Union, but there are lots of other things that I'm really keen on, making Britain a more fair and equal and, you know, the kind of stuff politicians say. She's been trotting out all of that stuff. But no, I don't think she's going to want to rush it. And in terms of Britain's relationship with the EU, she's going to be trying to square this circle. We know that she's not as anti-EU as the Brexiteers, obviously, but what she wants to do is to have as close a trading, a political, diplomatic relationship with the European Union as humanly and diplomatically possible, but while acknowledging the key thing that really won the referendum for Brexit, and that is immigration. She said there cannot be freedom of movement from the EU as usual, that something needs to be done about that. And I think that will be the focus of her negotiations.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. Rob, thanks.
Thank you.
Would you leave your job, your friends, take your family and move to a place with little connection to the modern world? Oh, and an old world foreign language? That's what Bill and Tricia Moser did. He was an architect, she an occupational therapist. They drove a BMW, an SUV, but there was a spiritual void, and so they became Amish. A story told in the new book, Becoming Amish, written by Bill Moser's childhood friend Jeff Smith. Jeff joins us from Interlochen Public Radio in Interlochen, Michigan. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And Bill Moser joins us from his home in Salem, Missouri by Skype. And that's a little bit of a clue. After over a decade, Bill and his family left the Amish community for another spiritual community. We're going to get to that as we welcome Bill. Bill, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin. Hello.
And I got to tell you, what a compelling read. You know, the lifestyle, every single sentence I kept asking myself, could I do this? You know, we want to find out what compelled you to do that. But how would you define Amish so we know what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's a complicated question because there's so many different varieties of Amish. Mm-hmm. Each community is fairly unique. It's a very hard thing to define.
Right, and they are defining it constantly, constantly questioning, well, should we use electricity for this or how should we address this? So it's constantly, even within each community, changing. But overall, we know that there's a sense of not being of this world, but also, from what I'm reading, for you, a sense of community.
Yeah, that was one of the major reasons we made the change. In looking at Jesus's teaching in the New Testament, we felt that that was a lack in our general American culture, and we sought a more purposeful way to live that out.
Well, and let's flesh that out a bit. Jeff, you talk about how liberals and conservatives would both find something to like in the Amish way of life.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things to me is how they do defy kind of the categories that we like to use in general society. And, you know, you think of the Amish as very conservative in dress, in lifestyle and whatnot, but they refuse to fight in wars. Likewise, liberals would love the way that the communities work together and support one another and give freely of their labor and even of their money, but liberals would be repelled by, say, their stance against abortion or gay marriage. And I guess what I found interesting in all that is we live by kind of all these boundaries that are sometimes put on us and sometimes we don't always think about them, right? Looking at the Amish, they sort of broke all that apart and remixed all those pieces.
And we have a broader picture of, we know that the men wear plain white shirts and suspenders and long pants round hats, and the women wear caps, and most of the communities have horse and buggies instead of cars. And so, Bill, just back to you and Trish. I mean, Trish went to the hairdresser. You know, you had kids that played video games and had computers. Weren't you frightened? I mean, what was that like to make that transition?
Well, it wasn't frightening. It was actually pretty exciting. And probably one of the biggest reasons is that we were pursuing spiritual goals and we saw that they could be fulfilled in a community setting like that. And so giving up things wasn't such a sacrifice compared to what we were gaining.
Well, you've been an architect. And now you found yourself coming up with ways to make money for your family, including making pallets. And one of the most interesting things about the Amish community is that businesses are not competitive with each other. In fact, people would come over and show you how they do their businesses. People give money for people to start up. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of the sharing nature that we as Christians should be practicing. helping one another, not in competition to one another, or even non-Christians. You mentioned the pallet business. Another pallet company that was owned by Amish individuals, they literally gave us the money to get started, gave us the equipment, gave us the orders, just handed it to us on a platter to help us get started.
And Jeff, you'd been childhood friends with Bill. You go for a visit. You hadn't seen him in years, as people do, drifted apart. You didn't know, and you walk up, and there's a horse and buggy and overalls, and he says to you, "Do you think we're crazy? Did you?"
Yeah. Well, I definitely thought, you know, Bill, we got some catching up to do, I think. I don't know. At first, I don't think I really knew what to think, but there was such a sense of peace around their home, and it was just such a beautiful moment, and you could simply feel it. I don't know what all led to me feeling that, but there was just this beautiful sense of peace and spirituality around their family and their home. And so, you know, I was very proud of them.
Well, and as Bill, you said, it's not you were never really on your own, because it's such a community-based lifestyle. But still, you're bringing kids with you. And, you know, one of the I didn't realize this, but apparently Amish children only go to school through the eighth grade. I can see the members outside the family thinking, oh, no, they've joined this cult or something. Our grandkids are going to not finish high school. I mean, tell us more about that.
That was probably the biggest concern of our relatives. They were concerned about the seeming lack of education. But even though their formal training went to the eighth grade, they're all still learning. In the Amish schools, those eighth grades are very foundational. They give them the tools to learn. It's a never-ending process.
Well, there's a lot of apprenticeship going on. And I was stunned at some of the things that your young kids were doing, taking over businesses at 19 or something like that. I mean, they're doing quite well. But Bill, this also makes me think of a line that Jeff attributes to you that just jumped out of it took my breath away. You said something like, when did we as Americans start thinking we should never be with our kids during the day?
Yeah, that was another motivational factor for us. I wanted to be more interactive with the family. I wanted my children beside me. I have four boys. I wanted to work with them, and that became a higher priority than pursuing a profession.
Well, and you have a daughter as well who spent a lot of her time with her mom and the women. There's a lot of work to do. And Jeff, that was a little tough to read because it was such a, you know, gender different experience. You know, the boys were out tagging along with their dad doing carpentry or training horses, and the girls were canning. But you describe complete joy.
The women in Bill's family are very strong. They're very strong women. They're very spirited. And back to your question, you know, what did I expect? I was thinking, well, when they move from general society to this, will they feel kind of shy and shut out of the general world, and will they be withdrawn or whatever? And what I found was completely the opposite. And that was actually one of the main things that struck me really early on, is how open their children were, all of them, including Sarah, and how spirited and strong and wanting to learn. And yes, there is that kind of division of labor that doesn't really fit with modern society, but it seems to work within that culture.
Bill, just, you know, again, it's so hard to conceive of in today's world. Did you ever yearn to, you know, download a song, or did your kids ever think, oh, you know, I really want to go to a movie?
Yeah, there was, but we had already, before we joined the Amish and we had homeschooled, we had gotten rid of our television years before we joined the Amish. So we are already used to different forms of entertainment. And because of our unique situation, we still had family and general society. So I'm not saying that we were 100% free of ever watching a movie or listening to a radio because of our contact with our family. But the desire, the yearning, even now, our children are in their early 20s, late teens, and there's just not that strong drive.
Well, it's interesting because it seems as if I'm reading this correctly, the thing that actually, when you decided to leave, it wasn't because of yearning for those things we've talked about. It was because of yearning again for more closeness and community. And because the community you were in spoke an old world German, you had to have an interpreter sitting the pew behind you interpreting every service in your ear, and that was just too distant from God for you?
That's right, Robin. Some of the very things that attracted us to the Amish kind of got, I would just call it, a little too rich. I believe the Bible would tell us that our spiritual lives should be in balance. So amongst the Amish, they're very separate and to the point where it got a little too separate for us. My children started having a longing to do, you know, maybe a mission project, go to Central America, serve there, things like that, that the Amish would stay away from. So it was those things that motivated our change more than material things.
Well, now you live in an Amish Mennonite community, this particular community. They use cars. We're hearing you talk by Skype. They use technology. And Jeff, did you, as you decided to write about your friends, did you go through some sort of Homeric journey as well? I mean, did you change as a person?
Well, you know, I was most struck by how intentional Bill and Tricia were about their lives, and not just the faith aspect of their life, but their family, their community, their business, their technology. And that was probably the biggest thing for me, is just kind of forcing me to look at my own life and look at those different pieces of my life and say, well, I don't intend to be Amish, but what am I learning from them that can kind of help me sort of assess each of those really big, important things in my own life? I feel like now in America, sort of the idea is if the individual is good, then the community will be good. And what Bill and Tricia's story kind of has taught me is if the community is good, the individual will be good. And that is something that I really carry with me in a much bigger way.
Jeff, Bill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
That's Jeff Smith, author of Becoming Amish. It tells the story of Bill and Tricia Mosiers and their decision to do just that. It's Here and Now.
And as the drought continues in the West, a giant robot is at work in a field in Arizona. Scientists are using it to study crops grown from biofuels under drought conditions. The Department of Energy has invested millions into this robotic recording system, and the hope is that as water supplies dwindle, this new tool could help fuel and feed a growing population. Casey Kuhn from Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
A huge metal frame sits in a field in front of the University of Arizona Agricultural Research Center. In it, a green square box attached to a hanging arm crawls back and forth along a track.
We had one person apparently come and ask if this had something to do with NSA or with communicating with aliens or something.
That's Jeff White, a plant researcher at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He, along with U of A engineer Pedro Andrade Sanchez, shows me the machine up close. And no, they're not trying to find extraterrestrial life in space. Rather, they're looking the other way, zooming in on little details in the Earth. Here's Sanchez.
It's like our eyes. So we look at crops and we look at how tall they are, how big, how green. What we're doing with this system is that we are using sensors to measure those same elements.
The big box scanning plants isn't just recording how they look. The sensors can also see non-visible light, showing how plants go through photosynthesis. White says it's a huge leap forward from walking through the fields and recording by hand. A game changer for agriculture, similar to
the Hubble Space Telescope and astronomy, where I think people knew it was going to be really powerful and interesting, but it's just astounded the world.
So we have
on our tour, White and Sanchez meet another researcher who recorded 180 plants in the last 4 hours by hand. The robot can scan more than 15,000 crops in the same amount of time.
It's really no way to compare it. You can have an army of people trying to get these things, and it's not going to be the same.
Crops are sorghum plants, a grain which can be grown for animal feed or, more importantly, biofuel. That's where the Department of Energy comes in. They've put millions of dollars into this project as part of a larger effort called Transportation Energy Resources from Renewable Agriculture, or TERRA. Director Joe Cornelius says the enormous amount of data the scanalyzer collects will be key looking ahead.
This is the future of agriculture, not just agriculture, but land management.
And while the hot, dry conditions of Arizona probably isn't the first place you think of when you hear farm research, Jeff White says it's just another way to prepare for a future with less water and more people.
You know, there's only a limited amount you can do if it's too hot or it's too dry, you know, if you don't, say, have access to irrigation.
Sorghum is made up of a lot of organic material like stalk and stems, which makes it good for biofuel research. But don't count on a miracle seed anytime soon.
This is not going to be something where we see huge increases in sorghum in the next 3 or 4 years, but at the 10-year mark, we might begin to see an impact at the level of commercial material.
At the end of our tour, Sanchez invites me to the top of the rig.
You're not going to fall.
Okay. He insists it's worth the 50-foot ladder climb.
From the ground, it just looks a big thing. From here, you see detail. You see a lot of elements. You can feel it. Well, first and foremost, you feel the movement.
And they're not just going to be looking at sorghum. The researchers plan to study wheat in the winter. For Here and Now, I'm Casey Kuhn.
The recent gun violence has renewed calls to lift the ban passed by Congress in 1996 on government research into gun violence that would advocate for gun control, a ban that effectively shut down any research. Dr. Jay Kaplan is an ER doctor in New Orleans and president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And Dr. Kaplan, this new call began after the Orlando shootings. Tell us more.
I was at a meeting of the House of Delegates of the American Medical Association in Chicago. And that Saturday night, early Sunday morning, was when the Orlando event occurred.
And what happened?
Well, I mean, my colleagues at Orlando Regional Medical Center were responsible for responding to the multiple patients who came in with their severe injuries. And when the fact of the mass casualties became known, there was an emergency resolution declaring that gun violence was a public health crisis in the United States and that we needed to do something about it. One of those things being to end the ban on firearm-related research.
Yeah. And then you as an individual, you got up a few days later and went to Washington.
Well, I was working in my emergency department on the 16th of June. And I received a call in the morning indicating that House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer was getting a group of legislative aides together and had invited a couple of physicians, me being one of the two, to come up and speak to them. My shift was done at 11 o'clock that night. I went home and got up at 3:30, caught a 5:40 a.m. flight to Washington, and was on Capitol Hill by 10 o'clock speaking to these aides.
Well, look, we should mention you have a personal connection to the issue of gun violence. Your niece was shot.
Yeah, my niece was shot at Thurston High School. She was in the school cafeteria and heard some loud bangs and saw some blood on her clothes and thought maybe she was having her period and then all of a sudden recognized that she had been shot. And she has found her way through after dealing with the post-traumatic stress and still carries the scars.
Well, it still carries part of the bullet.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, by the way, was the 1998 shooting at Thurston High in Springfield, Oregon. A young man killed his parents, then went to the school, killed two students, wounded 25, including your niece. And we're glad to remember them all here. But on that trip in Washington, talking to lawmakers and their aides, you suggested that maybe a personal experience like you had would change the opinion of lawmakers. But they told you that they have a personal connection.
Yeah, that was rather sad, I have to say. I was saying what it would take to create some action would be if one of the congressmen or senators' own children or spouses were shot. And this young man spoke up and said, well, our own Gabby Giffords got shot and we couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And then he challenged me and he said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, give me any platform to speak and I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah. Because as emergency physicians, we see this every day. We see the effects of gun violence every day and we're the ones that have to deal with it, not only emergently in terms of the injuries that patients sustain, but the families that come in afterwards to find out that their loved ones were either killed or severely injured.
Well, it's interesting. The man who first proposed this ban in an amendment in 1996 now says that banning all federal research into gun violence was not his intent at all. Here's former Congressman Jay Dickey of Arkansas. Let's listen.
It turned out that that's what happened, but it wasn't aimed at that. And it wasn't necessary that all research stop. It just couldn't be the collection of data so that they can advocate gun control. That's all we were talking about. But for some reason, it just stopped altogether.
Your thoughts?
Well, that's in fact what happened. You know, it seems to me that if there's a problem, we want to face the problem head on and say, this is an issue. What are we going to do about it? Let's study it. Let's propose some solutions. And then let's try those solutions out. Let's pilot those solutions and then analyze and see whether they worked or not. Well, with regard to gun-related violence, we haven't had that opportunity.
Well, again, Dr. Jay Kaplan, again, an emergency room doctor in New Orleans, you can hear in Congressman Dickey's voice a real confusion. We didn't really want to ban research. We just wanted to stop all research that would advocate gun control. So there's some disconnect there, some confusion, as we said. But, you know, the gun lobby thinks that's exactly what would happen with this research. Is there really anything else that could be done with gun violence research except limit the sale of guns?
Well, gun violence research might show that it makes sense for more people to carry guns. We don't know. And there is an assumption by those who oppose efforts to lift the ban, there is an assumption that if you do research, that it's going to lead to gun control. Now, we don't know that because we don't have the research. A colleague of mine who's an emergency physician said to me, you know, gun violence is not a public health issue. And I said, it kills over 32,000 people a year. That certainly is a public health issue. And then I asked him about research, and he said, well, you know, that research will be biased. And to me, that's an excuse. Because I think as scientists, you know, the reason that we do research is to define problems and to create solutions. Good scientific research is research that's done without bias. And there's no reason to think that we couldn't do research on gun-related violence and do it without bias.
Well, you know, bias would imply that you would try to tilt the findings towards saying that gun use should be limited, gun sales should be limited. But is there, really, honestly, do you think that there could be any other conclusion from studying gun violence? Without bias. Let the research play itself out.
Well, that's how I would look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, the interesting thing is when I was a resident back many years ago in the mid-70s, we used to take care of, I was at a trauma center in Northern California. We used to take care of a lot of patients who came in with motorcycle injuries, and there was no helmet law at the time. And so we used to call motorcycles the entry point to the ECU, not the ICU, the ECU, which was the eternal care unit, because when people would fall off motorcycles, they'd hit their head and they'd die. Now, we know that guns cause a problem, and the question is, can we try to find some solutions, whatever they are, that could help decrease the number of people who are dying? And by the way, let me just say, you know, people talk about gun violence and they assume that we're talking about somebody shooting somebody else. But 2/3 of the deaths related to gun violence are suicides.
Well, and another percentage is accidents. We've had a run lately of little kids finding guns under the seats in front of them and then shooting through the seats and killing their mothers.
Yeah, very sad.
So perhaps one of the results of research could be safety.
I would like to think that as with other public health issues, when we find solutions and we implement solutions, we decrease deaths and it leads to a healthier community. And I would like to think that gun research would do the same.
Yeah. As you well know, President Obama issued an executive order commanding the CDC to get back to studying the causes of gun violence. He requested $10 million for that research. The Boston Globe has reported on that. But Congress didn't approve the funding. The research never resumed. And the NRA says that the organization does not object to legitimate research. What they object to is taxpayer-funded studies done to promote an anti-gun agenda. Is there any way for you and some of these medical organizations to organize and raise funds for independent research?
The answer is yes. And are we in the process of attempting to do so? And the answer is yes, not in the organized fashion that the CDC could do, or the National Institutes of Health could do. And that's what we're really looking for. We're looking for some kind of well-funded, organized effort at looking at solutions to gun-related violence.
Really, how much gun violence do you see? What do you see?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. Where I practice now in New Orleans, we are not a trauma center. But if you go down to our colleagues downtown at a University Medical Center, they see knife and gun injuries every day, multiple times a day. And when I practiced in Northern California, when I was doing my residency, the last shift that I worked, I had 5 patients who had gunshot wounds and 5 patients who were stabbed. That's what we see as emergency physicians. If you're in a trauma center, in an inner city urban trauma center, it's very common to see that.
That's Dr. Jay Kaplan, ER doctor in New Orleans and president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, looking to lift the ban on CDC studying gun violence. Dr. Kaplan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
The killings in Dallas, Minnesota, and Baton Rouge last week have many talking about polarization in America. "We are a divided nation," was the tweet from Donald Trump yesterday. On Friday, the New York Post ran the front page headline, "Civil War." Former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey described it this way on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
Well, we are sitting on a powder keg. I mean, it's you can call it a powder keg. You could say that we're handling nitroglycerin. But obviously, when you just look at what's going on, we're in a very, very critical point in the history of this country.
But President Obama over the weekend had a different view.
As painful as this week has been, I firmly believe that America is not as divided as some have suggested.
Bring in Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So when you hear people say America in crisis, civil war, etc., what are your thoughts about that?
It's complicated because there are real divisions. Let's take race, for example. There was a Pew survey out a few weeks ago that found that black people were significantly more likely to say that race relations in the U.S. Were bad. But what's interesting is that although the country as a whole thinks race relations have gone backward under Obama, the one group that told Pew that the president has made progress on race relations was the black respondents in that Pew survey. So this seems like a paradox that blacks are both more likely to see a race divide and more likely to say that things are getting better. But that's just it. Think about it this way. Black Americans are more likely to say things are bad but getting better. White Americans are more likely to say things are all right but getting worse. And one factor that I think is contributing to both of these stories, to both sides of the paradox, is social media, which essentially has made it easier for white people to see the black experience. I say see and not understand because there's a big difference. It is the beginning of empathy. But this beginning of empathy, I think, enabled by social media, has awakened a lot of people to the reality of police brutality and the inequality of black life. And this has made it seem as if things are getting much, much worse.
Well, I want to ask you about that, the role of social media. I was watching the program Reliable Sources on CNN over the weekend, and there was a newspaper media critic who was saying that social media has made it possible for reporters even to say things that then had to be deleted because they would never have been printed in the first place, because they don't have to go through the layers of editorial process that used to have to be done in the past, but that can inflame the situation as well. And then the Wall Street Journal has an interesting piece called Blue Feed, Red Feed, where you can pick an issue like the Dallas shooting and see what the Facebook feed of a liberal looks like alongside that of a conservative, and they're totally different. Is social media dividing the country even more?
This is a complicated question, an important question. I think of social media, things like Facebook, as analogous not to a single publication, but rather as analogous to a platform. So was radio good or bad for America? Was the invention of newspapers good or bad? Was television good or bad? Obviously, these are really complicated questions, and with Facebook and social media, it is similarly complicated. On the one hand, yes, social media does allow ourselves to surround each individual with like-minded friends and peers, allows people to build mirrors around us so we're more likely to see opinions that adhere closely to the ideas we already have. On the other hand, no, social media is not an altogether negative force. It is very effective, as I said, at showing all Americans the divisions that already exist. And this has the effect, I think, of making some people think that things are getting worse when in fact what they're really seeing is a situation that has always existed, but for the first time.
And in the case of the shootings last week by police of black men, even broadcasting those live in a way that they never would have been before. The other thing is, Derek, we're talking about division in America and racial division, but there are also economic divisions. There are generational divisions. We just saw that in the UK with the Brexit vote. A lot of the young people saying stay in the UK and the older people saying no, let's stay in the EU rather, and the older people saying let's leave. There are a lot of kinds of divisions.
Yeah, one of the most important divisions in the U.S. to keep in mind, I think, and it's hard to remember this obvious fact, America is huge. To quote Walt Whitman, it contains multitudes. So when we say things like America thinks, we have to be careful. Mm. Do Americans want more gun control, for example? Well, many liberal cities absolutely do, and many suburban and rural areas in red states absolutely do not. And this is becoming harder to talk about as people sort themselves by income and by geography. So, for example, an amazing statistic. In 2001, the 50 richest metro areas produced 27% more per person than the national average. Now they produce 34% more. So it's not just polarization, it's agglomeration too. Rich cities getting richer and poorer areas getting poorer. And this also makes America seem more divided.
Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and we welcome your thoughts at our website, hereandnow.org. How divided do you think America is right now? Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.